On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If ever there was a shared, sacred text in this country, it is the U.S. Constitution. And the people who drafted it, the James Madisons, the Ben Franklins, and Thomas Jeffersons, are, for most of us, the high priests of all that has gone right in our history. Men who somehow understood in an earlier, simpler time the fundamental rules of human nature and built a system of government that perfectly balanced our best and worst natures. Wrong, says constitutional scholar Sanford Levinson. The Constitution is old hat, and the framers are from another age, he says. Time for today's best minds to get together for an historic rewrite, he says. Time for a bold, beautiful new document. This hour, On Point, one scholar's call for a modern, democratic constitution. Joining me now from Washington is Sanford Levinson. He's professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas School of Law. His provocative new book is titled Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It. Professor Levinson, nice to have you here with us.
Thank you very much. Very glad to be here.
And joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst and senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Jack, hello to you.
Hello, Jane, and hello, Professor Levinson.
Hello.
Professor Levinson, you know, you're a really unlikely advocate for revolutionary changes to the Constitution. You've spent your life teaching, interpreting, upholding the Constitution, yet here you are calling for an almost top-to-bottom overhaul of it. What's so bad with the Constitution that we've got?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways in which it's simply undemocratic, that there are so many impediments to majority rule that it actually presents a paradox these days when the United States often declares that we want to encourage democracy on the world. We should begin, I think, by looking at our own Constitution and whether it passes a 21st century test of democracy, even if it did quite splendidly pass a late 18th century version of democracy. The easiest example is that Wyoming has the same number of votes in the Senate as California, even though California has 70 times the population. If we believe, as I think we do in the 21st century, in some notion of one person, one vote, a quality of voting power, then the Senate is indefensible on that basis. And just as important, this isn't simply kind of a theoretical or an aesthetic objection that the Senate would look prettier if the voting were more equal, but it has real consequences for the making of public policy. 5% of the population, largely in the Rocky Mountain states in the upper Midwest, have 25% of the votes in the Senate. And this means that an awful, awful lot of federal funds end up going to those states. And they're taken away, quite frankly, from bigger states that have certainly just as much problems that need to be met, but they're not adequately met by a federal government that really is stacked in favor of small states. That's only one problem, but it should be one that, you know, kind of is just out there. There are others dealing with the presidential veto, for
example.
Well,
we'll get to all those, but and you've given one example of how you want states to be represented in proportion to their population. But let me get back to this very basic question of a constitution as a sacred document. Do you see it as an expendable document?
Not all of it. I don't want to tear it up and just start all over again. But I do think that we actually should learn from the framers. The book is not an attack on the framers. One of the things they emphasized was learning from experience. And in 217 years, we have a lot of experience, and we should realize that there are some ways in which it really is a terrific constitution, but are there other ways in which it is exactly as you described it, that it is like driving a car with very bad tires and almost no brakes. And we're like teenagers who are confident that because it's gotten us home safely in the past, it's going to not take us over the cliff the next time. And I think that we really ought to become much more aware of the extent to which the Constitution does threaten to take us over a variety of cliffs.
In your book, Professor, you call for a constitutional revolution of sorts, an upheaval, a national constitutional convention to rebuild our entire government structure. Is it feasible in our current political climate with such extraordinary partisanship, also in the middle of a war in a very unstable world?
Yeah. Actually, let me make the argument that this is actually the best time to have a constitutional convention or a serious national conversation leading to a convention with regard to what I really focus on in the book, which are what I call the hardwired structures of the Constitution. No time could be better, in fact, than when the country is divided very evenly 50-50 for a very simple reason. Nobody knows who's going to be president in 2009. Nobody knows who's going to control Congress. Nobody knows who's going to be making judicial appointments. So what you have is kind of a perfect circumstance where Democrats and Republicans could actually talk in a fairly disinterested way about what sorts of power they want the president to have in 2010, 2015, 2020, whether the country is well served, for example, by lame duck sessions, which we've got right now, instead of changing the system so that newly elected representatives take office within a week of their election. So you don't have the anomaly that we do now of a discredited Congress that's still meeting and capable of making decisions. So, you know, I agree with you completely that this would be a terrible time to talk about abortion, affirmative action, religion, control of guns and the like, because the country is way too split to have any serious conversation or come to any sort of genuine agreement on those. But those aren't really the issues I'm talking about. I'm talking about the hardwired Constitution, which I really do think presents all sorts of problems.
Jack Beatty, let me bring you in here. What do you think? Sound right?
Well, you know, this convention would be an extended debate between Thomas Jefferson, who really thought the Constitution should be rethought every generation, and said, "Let us not weakly believe that one generation is not as capable as another of taking care of itself. The dead have no rights." Jefferson on one side and James Madison on the other, who said that frequent appeals to the public would remove that veneration which time bestows on everything, and without which perhaps the wisest and freest governments would not possess the requisite stability. So that would be the debate. But imagine the scene at that convention. As the delegates entered, Joan Rivers and Borat would buttonhole them. Rivers asking who designed their outfits and whether their breasts were real. Borat manipulating them into singing "Throw the Methodists Down the Well." The delegates would then face a gauntlet of clashing kooks. Look at it. Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson on one side calling down hellfire on those who refused to enfranchise the fetus. Tom and Katie, Matt and Ben, Paris Hilton and Al Sharpton, Mel Gibson and Alan Dershowitz all shouting at once, Mel in tongues. In and around the convention, meanwhile, Warner Brothers would be filming Closing Time at the Electoral College, starring Jack Black as the new dean of students, Catherine Harris as the aloof microbiologist he's pursuing, and the combined cast, this would be terrific, of School of Rock, Apocalypto, and Jackass 2 as the state electors threatened with extinction by a mad law professor played by Anthony Hopkins. You wouldn't want to miss it.
Jack, you've been up all night working on that, I can tell. Professor Levinson, but let me get back to this point. Are these ideas genuine? Or are they somewhat unrealistic? And if they are genuine proposals, is it a valuable exercise to get our country thinking?
Oh, they're certainly genuine proposals, because I really have been thinking about this for a long time. And I'd like to think that the book lays out the argument as to why we're not well served by the Electoral College, we're not well served by life tenure in the Supreme Court, we're not well served by a policy-based presidential veto, we're not well served by a system in which we feel stuck with a president till the end of an elected term, even if the country at large comes to the conclusion that the particular president is unfit for the office. And we had many people who thought that with regard to Bill Clinton his last several years, and certainly a lot of people believe that now with George Bush. I think that these ideas are very, very much worth discussing. And I come back to what I was saying a moment ago. I think what Jack Beatty said is right, if I were proposing a national conversation about really and truly resolving the hot button issues that he mentioned. But part of the problem is the issues I'm focused on, most people, I think, believe are kind of boring. They're civics book issues. But they, in fact, have much, much more to do with our politics and much more to do with whether or not, for example, presidents are going to be interested in the problems of the great American cities. Part of the perversity of the Electoral College is that presidents have no incentive to be interested in the great American cities because most of them are in so-called safe states. And presidents don't campaign in states that either they take for granted as part of their own base or just write off because they're the other guy's base. There are all sorts of ways in which, you know, the difficulty of our system in responding to the medical air crisis. Part of the reason for that is that, contrary to what people learned in their civics classes, we don't have a bicameral system. We have a tricameral system because the president on his own, by the signing a veto statement, basically becomes a third house of the legislature. And so it becomes immensely difficult, almost to the point of impossibility, of coming to any kind of genuine resolution about any of the problems that really confront us as society. And thus, Congress has a temptation to engage in sheer grandstanding, flag-burning amendments, gay marriage amendments, and the like, that most members of Congress know aren't going to go anywhere. Because it's just easier to do that in our system than really try to confront serious issues of public policy, because we have a system that really works against resolving serious issues.
Professor Levinson, let me go back to the top now and have you go through some of the points that you suggest in your book. Number one, you want to change the Constitution to essentially remove a president from office if he's not up to the job, as I just mentioned, a sort of no-confidence mechanism, if you will, for a president with whom the populace has lost confidence. Is that right?
Yes. It would seem to me very desirable, for example, if two-thirds of Congress meeting together, the House and Senate together, if they voted no confidence, that you could replace that person with somebody we had more confidence in. Now, there things get a little bit complicated, and it's useful to compare, actually, Clinton and Bush in this score. Those people who thought that Bill Clinton really had proved his unfitness for the office with regard to the Monica Lewinsky affair could not fairly say that Al Gore wasn't fit to be president. So there you would have simple succession by the vice president and everything would be all right. With regard to the current situation, anybody who is perturbed by George Bush really isn't going to be much happier if Dick Cheney succeeds him. So there you'd have to have a mechanism really to change both president and vice president. And what I suggest is that the best way to do it is that if you did have that two-thirds vote, then the caucus of the president's own party could designate a successor to fill out the term. And I emphasize that it would be the president's own party because I certainly don't support the possibility of what might be called a party coup. In fact, although this isn't a constitutional issue, I think it's crazy that we have a succession in office act that makes Nancy Pelosi two heartbeats away from the presidency, or made Newt Gingrich two heartbeats away from President Clinton, because I think it would be a terrible idea if we ever had a case in which we didn't have a president and vice president to change parties as well as leaders. This recognizes the reality that we really are a party government. Part of the problem with the president is that we treat the president as an all-powerful individual. The president is not shouldn't be treated that way. He really is, or she in the future, is the head of a political party. And when enough people in that political party, plus obviously members of the other political party, are willing to pull the plug, then I see no reason why the president should be viewed as having an unbreakable lease in the White House.
So your model for removing a president from office sounds a bit like the British parliamentary system, right? The Tories removed Margaret Thatcher. The Labour Party is doing the same with Tony Blair. Is it the same model?
Yes. It's certainly borrowed from that. I do not, in fact, in the book, advocate shifting to a parliamentary system because I really would like to hear more conversation about whether we're better off with some kind of presidential system or a parliamentary system. There are no perfect systems of government.
John,
but certainly I would borrow this feature from the British parliamentary system. And the Thatcher and Blair examples are really very useful because Margaret Thatcher was not succeeded by a Labourite. She was succeeded by John Major, who in fact won the next election. And the paradox is that I suspect that a lot of Republicans these days would far prefer that, say, John McCain be president. And he would be obviously an extraordinarily strong candidate. He already is an extraordinarily strong candidate for 2008. So the political party itself, as was the case in Great Britain, would have an incentive to pull the plug when they came to the conclusion that the current head of their party in the White House really isn't up to the job.
You also believe, Professor, that the president has become too powerful. You argue the president's emergency powers, which are now unspecified in the Constitution, should be spelled out and limited. And you want to limit the president's veto power. Explain why a presidential veto is a bad thing.
Right. Well, because I think that it's hard enough to get legislation through with two houses. And I, in fact, support two houses. I have problems with the representation, the votes in the Senate, but I don't have a problem with the Senate as such. The problem I have is that the modern veto, and I don't think the framers had any real idea that this is what the veto would turn into, really turns out to be politics-based. It's not the president making constitutional arguments. I'm perfectly comfortable with a constitution-based veto. The president takes an oath of office to support protecting within the Constitution. The president should not be forced to sign a bill that he or she believes is unconstitutional. You may be interested to know that I actually have some sympathy for the basic structure of the Bush administration arguments with regard to signing statements, though I disagree very, very much often with their very specific constitutional arguments.
Well, at this point, I'd also like to introduce another voice into the conversation, John McGinnis. He's a constitutional scholar, teaches law at Northwestern University. He joins me now from Chicago. Professor McGinnis, good to have you with us.
Good day.
Professor McGinnis, veto party-based politics, does that sound right to you?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think there are a lot of very interesting proposals in Professor Levinson's book, some of which I would agree with, either through statute or discrete constitutional amendment. But these larger proposals, like getting rid of the presidential veto, I have some reservations about, and maybe the presidential veto is a good example of that. It is absolutely true that political scientists say that creates more veto points. It makes it harder for legislation to pass. But I think there are some advantages of that. And I think the framers of the Constitution were quite conscious about it because they actually thought that there should be require a greater than majority consensus before we have legislation. Because they recognize that actually democracy is sort of vacillating and that we have other social norms to create through markets and other matters that create civil society. And before we interfere with that, we should have a substantial consensus and more a consensus that's likely to endure in society. And so bicameralism and presentment do that. And I think there's an argument for that rather than kind of more simple majoritarian democracy.
Jack Beatty, add your voice here.
Well, my voice is that this is an incomplete, if you're going to go for a constitutional convention, why not go whole hog? I mean, my hobby horse is proportional representation. In our system, it's winner take all. A congressman or a woman wins a race, and if they get 50.1% of the vote, they represent the whole district. And those 49% of Republicans, if it's a Democrat who wins, are disfranchised. If we increase the number of members of the House of Representatives and adopted a PR system, the system would be more democratic because it would be more representative. And it would increase voter interest and turnout. In Massachusetts, for example, I think, 3/4 of the congressional candidates had no opposition last time because that's a Democratic state. Mm-hmm. Under proportional representation, the Republicans in those districts would get some say in the government. And it would allow also for the existence of third parties, which I think we badly need. So I say, Professor, good for you, but let's go on to PR.
Professor, do you want to answer?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't disagree with that. I think the worst example of Jack Beatty's point is the Electoral College, where the way it's constructed now, there is this winner-take-all feature. I happen to split my time between two states, Texas and Massachusetts. There's no reason for Democrats to vote in Texas. There's no reason for Republicans to vote in Massachusetts with regard to the presidential race because, for all intents and purposes, the vote is irrelevant. It would seem to me if we're going to stick with the Electoral College, which I do want to get rid of, at the very least, there ought to be mechanisms whereby the minorities in given states would actually, in effect, have their votes counted. This would also lead to presidential campaigns being something other than focusing on a very few battleground states. But the broader issues that Jack Beatty is talking about, I'm quite sympathetic with. Some of these things, though, as John McGinnis suggested, could be handled by statutes in the various states, that they're not hardwired into the Constitution the way the issues that I'm focusing on are hardwired.
Let me continue with the Electoral College, though, for just a minute, Professor, because I was actually surprised to read in your book that nearly half of our presidents, 19 presidents, correct me if I'm wrong, I think captured the majority of the Electoral College, but didn't collect a majority of the popular vote. Yes?
Right, right. There is a disconnect on that. Since World War II alone, Harry Truman became president, John F. Kennedy became president, Richard Nixon the first time became president, Bill Clinton both times, and of course, very notably, George Bush in the year 2000, without getting majority of the vote. And going back to Jack Beatty's point, there are a variety of other voting systems, even in selecting a single winner, that can correct for this particular problem, and I think that it is a problem that the president, I mean, going back to the veto for a moment, one of the justifications of the veto is the idea that the president is the tribune of the people, elected by the people, and speaks really for the nation in a way that no member of Congress speaks for the nation because all of them are elected locally. But if, in fact, the president doesn't have the support of a majority of the people, and if, in fact, the president is elected through a perverse system of political campaigning, because one of the things I know that John McGinnis and I agree on is that the Electoral College shapes the nature of political campaigns. So if the president is elected because of strong appeal to relatively few battleground states, I think the legitimacy of the presidential veto is really lost.
Well, let me get back to the Electoral College with Professor McGinnis. Are populous states really put at a disadvantage by the Electoral College?
I don't think actually that is true, populous, because actually it might seem that way, but you have to look at it kind of mathematically. And if the question is for a presidential candidate, he has to figure out a way of getting together a coalition that's going to win. And it's much more likely that a large state is going to be decisive than a small state. And there have actually been mathematicians who've looked at that question and show that the large states, therefore, are not disadvantaged. But if I might say sort of more generally about the Electoral College, I think it goes back to, I think, my most fundamental disagreement with Professor Levinson, which is just I'm doubtful that democracy can quite deliver perhaps what he hopes it can. I mean, any Electoral College decision is a kind of snapshot in time. If the vote had been a week before or after, different people might have won. The question, in my view, is does it get someone who has substantial support and who everyone looks at legitimately as president? And it performs in that way, and it performs, I think, pretty well. I'm not saying it's the best system, and maybe another system's better, but it doesn't worry me, and I think we really need to look practically, concretely at the results of our system. Has our system been worse than parliamentary systems in Europe? I'm sort of skeptical of that. Certainly, it seems to me that there are a lot of indications that American society is more healthy than those of Europe, and I don't want to say it's because of our electoral system, but I'm a little cautious in making these rather abstract reasoning to overturn a system that seems to have worked relatively well. It's for 200 years. While I'm up completely open to tweaking it with discrete constitutional amendments, like ones about lame duck sessions that I think Professor Levinson has very usefully put on the table. Mm.
We have a lot of callers on the line. I want to get to who've been listening to our conversation. Haywood is calling from Lebanon, Tennessee. Haywood, nice to have you.
Good day. I disagree with this thing that he's proposing that the Congress and the Senate could remove the president. That's one more step of taking the power away from the people, because if you get an opposing party, you know, what's to say that whoever is elected, they say, well, we don't like this guy, and corrupt power in the Senate or in the House says, let's figure out a way to get rid of him. I don't like the way he's doing it. He's no good. He's incompetent. Vote him out.
Professor Levinson?
I think there are two quick answers. First of all, from the conversation we were just having a minute or two ago, the president may or may not be the choice of the people, because so many of them, in fact, don't even have majority support. But remember, I would never allow the party in opposition to the president to take over, both practically and more theoretically. It would always require extensive support from the president's own party, and the successor would come from the president's own party. So I think that it is more dangerous, frankly, to have a system in which the American people feel stuck with somebody a majority of them may not have voted for, or they voted for because the political atmospherics were so different, and then they, you know, wake up every morning really being nervous about this person being in office. So I really don't have the fear that your caller did. I'm more fearful, given the power of the modern presidency, particularly with regard to foreign and military affairs, of having somebody in office we really don't have confidence in to serve America's most basic interests, including protecting the lives of American troops.
But don't popularity numbers change, poll numbers change, popularity shifts. Electorates can be very finicky, as you know. You might be getting rid of a president for a temporary dip in popularity. And what about, you know, these one-day scandals or a drop in the polls that blow over in this modern-day news cycle?
Right. I'm not talking about a California recall election. I'm talking about serious professional politicians on both sides of the aisle. I view all of my proposals as nonpartisan. I'm assuming that most of the people in Washington, even those I disagree with vehemently on particular policies, actually have the interests of the country at large. They're not going to do this except in exceptional situations. And what would guarantee that is that you would need a supermajority for a vote of no confidence, I think two-thirds, and inevitably it would need to be partisan. And just to repeat, the greatest guarantee against the kind of coup that your caller is afraid of is that successor would be from the president's own party. Mm.
Professor Levinson, let me go to this idea again of the Constitutional Convention. How do you foresee it? What would it look like? Who would be there? And what exactly would happen?
Well, that, of course, is the hardest question. Let me say one thing that I agree with John McGinnis on, that a number of the things that I'm talking about wouldn't require a convention. What they would require is getting the attention of Congress to think about serious amendment. What would require a convention, I think, would be modifying the basis of representation in the Senate, because, frankly, it is impossible to imagine that happening through the ordinary procedures. The framers might have done a good job in some ways, though I think actually we overestimate the extent to which they wrote a document that succeeded for 200 years. We forget the Civil War, and we forget the extent to which the Constitution made its own contribution to causing the Civil War. Article 5 of the Constitution does talk about a convention. Unfortunately, they didn't provide a clue as to what the convention actually would look like, which is why your question is obviously a terrific one. I'm not trying to suggest waving a magic wand and getting a convention next week, because we're not going to have that. What I want to encourage is a long overdue national conversation about whether we're well served by our current constitution. I obviously think the answer is no.
Well, you heard Jack Beatty, but let me interrupt you for just a minute, because I think this is an important point. Jack Beatty alluded to this at the beginning. A national conversation these days is not what it used to be. Can you imagine the 24-hour news cycle, cable news, the blogosphere? Do you really think that a superior constitutional document would emerge from our current political and cultural climate?
I'm actually much less pessimistic on that score. Professor McGinnis and I disagree on lots of things, but I think we're having a civil conversation here this morning. We've been at conferences together and have had civil conversations. I'm not saying we would agree on all of the matters we're talking about, but I think these questions of hardwired structure really don't have the partisan political valence that the sorts of issues that cable covers. I mean, the problem, as I said at the outset, is that most people view things like the veto, lifetime appointments of the Supreme Court, when it is that newly elected presidents take over and stuff like that, as boring. And they really get excited about things like guns or abortion or gay marriage or whatever. So, yes, I really do think that if there were a conversation that eventuated in thoughtful people saying, you know, it really is worth taking a look at some of these hardwired problems, I'm really quite confident that people who disagree vehemently on a lot of the hot button issues could sit down and have really serious conversations. I mean, let me give you an example.
Well, let me ask Professor McGinnis to jump in here, because I'd like to hear his voice. John, are you confident that that would happen?
No, I'm afraid I'm not. And I think there's a difference between the situation we are in and the situation the framers were in. Their alternative, they were a fledgling democracy, which might have been destroyed by the European powers. And so the alternatives really forced them to concentrate their minds. Here, if we didn't have a new constitution, we'd go on our old constitution, which is not quite, obviously not disastrous. And I think that what that would do is would actually empower people not to talk about, I think, the serious structural issues, but to do what political entrepreneurs do, to talk about issues with greater, what political scientists call salience, the hot button issues, abortion, and those matters, because that would get their various factions riled up. And so I'm a little pessimistic, precisely because, it's the paradox, is precisely because our Constitution is at least pretty good, or at least is structured a pretty successful system, it's going to make it hard to get people to focus on the really important matters, because people are just going to say, really, if nothing happens, it really doesn't matter, because we've got a pretty good system anyway.
In fact, James Madison, one of the founding fathers, insisted the Constitution had been adopted under unusually favorable historic circumstances. Frank from Nashville, Tennessee, has a point related to that. Frank, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to refer to something Professor Levinson said earlier. He said the reason for doing this was that the Constitution, it wasn't democratic enough. I understand that's with a lowercase d. That was the whole purpose of the document. The founders, they found democracy to be abhorrent, and rightly so. It's just mob rule. That's why they chose a representative form of government. And so by reversing that, aren't we seriously altering the whole direction of the country?
Professor Levinson?
Well, Frank is making a good point, that it's certainly true that none of the framers had much good to say about democracy, but what they were referring to was direct rule by the people. And Frank is absolutely right that what they prefer is representative government, which means that the people actually elect people who will represent them. And the notion is that these people, among other things, will have more time to spend on serious issues of governance and the like. And I'm very happy with representative government. The other point, though, I think, is that we live in a different world, for better or worse. I would say for better, though maybe in some ways for worse, that our general culture is a more little d democratic culture, not direct democracy, not the California recall sorts of procedures. But I think that we do live in the 21st century in a culture that believes that the idea of one person, one vote really defines what democracy means.
Jack Beatty, I'm going to ask you to answer that. Jump in here.
Well, I'm all for that. I just wonder, though, and I'm all for, certainly, I think the 2000 election showed how critical it was to reexamine the Electoral College. I mean, one official in the state of Florida, Catherine Harris, who was a party person, not a, you know, some sort of disinterested state bureaucrat, could stop the whole machinery of elections. That's delegitimizing our whole system, and that wouldn't be so in a if we were to get rid of the Electoral College. So I think there's a very strong argument for that. I'm just, I guess, coming down now with Professor McGinnis. There are latent virtues in the system we have, and they're not, it's hard to defend them necessarily because they don't emerge with that clarity. And yet if you were to start to alter it, I'm just afraid that some of those some of the latent virtues would disappear, and we'd be left with something imponderable and hard to contain. Also, I just don't think it's possible to split that hair to say we're going to talk about the hardwired matters of structure and we're going to leave the cultural and social issues out. It just couldn't happen that way. The politicians would never allow it to happen that way, and precisely because it wouldn't be democratic that way. Democratic would say, we want to get what majorities want into the Constitution. Hmm.
Let me take another call. Jerry is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. You know, the last speaker was so eloquent. For me, I'm going through a period of, I think I'm experiencing what so many Americans are, which is a real sense of societal vertigo. I feel like we're in danger of losing more and more of our institutions, the things that defined us when the Constitution was first written. Those men were in a situation where they had to, circumstances forced upon them the need to frame a document that distilled what this country was going to be built around. And now we have the luxury to debate it, and I think that's wonderful. But at a time when we're debating things like what's the nature of marriage, what's the right to life, immigration, religion. An article in the paper in Nashville of last week talked about how Christians maybe need to rethink the idea of emphasizing Christ so much so we'd get along better with others. Mm-hmm. I just don't think this is a very good time to be revamping things in a time where we have so few things to guide us.
Thank you, Jerry. He has a good point, Professor Levinson.
Well, you know, I think the truly wonderful thing about the Constitution is the preamble. And I think that the preamble does offer us as a country a set of values, a set of aspirations that we can all in the 21st century continue to rally around. The real question is whether the institutions that the framers in 1787 and 88 designed for us are really adequate to achieving the goals of the preamble. I'd like to go back actually to one of the things that Jack Beatty said, because it seems to me that the argument he's making and the argument that John McGinnis is making is a version of it's not broke so it doesn't need fixing. That actually could be made with regard to every single change we've had in our history, including popular election of senators, including an amendment that in fact did move up the date for the inauguration of the president and changed the time when newly elected Congress met in session. It, you know, there were even people who said during the Civil War that actually we're really getting into dangerous waters if we get rid of slavery and pass something called the 14th Amendment. I don't believe in change for change's sake. I do believe that if we want to stick with the Constitution we've got, that we should make a conscious decision that the Constitution is really serving us well and that it doesn't have some of the real dangers that I think it presents. I think we're just way too complacent in our view that there are no risks attached to sticking with the Constitution, that all the risks come with regard to change. And, you know, a convention might or might not be successful. If it really takes the form that Jack Beatty suggested at the beginning of the program, then nothing's going to happen. And the Constitution we have will continue indefinitely.
Jack Beatty had such a good point about the latent virtues of the Constitution. And I have a question for Professor McGinnis, because I know you believe, Professor McGinnis, that some of the features of the Constitution that Professor Levinson dislikes are just what the Founding Fathers intended. Isn't that right?
Yes. I do think the biggest difference is Professor Levinson is more enthusiastic about the possibilities of democracy than either the framers or even representative democracy. I mean, I certainly think they thought a government with consent was important, but that's not the only way we structure society. We structure society through markets, through social norms, which I think the framers and I think are largely beneficial. And that means that it's a good thing that we require a very substantial consensus through bicameralism, presidential veto, before changing matters, because that actually protects our system, gives kind of stability to our system, because businesses can plan much more easily if they know the laws aren't going to rapidly change. We also are able to take a more stable stance towards our alliances if we don't have great changes, or it's hard to change our basic the way we're going. And so I do think there is a deep disagreement between Professor Levinson and I think some of the founding genius of the Constitution. That doesn't mean he's wrong, but I do think it's important to point out that there, I think, is a matter of principle in debate here.
I want to go back to a couple of your points in your book, Professor Levinson. You mentioned the reapportionment of the Senate in the legislative branch. I wanted to ask you about this one person, one vote notion. Doesn't the Constitution preserve the idea of one person, one vote in the House of Representatives, where states do receive that representation based on their population?
Sure. Sure. But the way the government works, where both houses are equal, if you look around the world, it's not necessarily the case that both houses in a two-house system are necessarily equal. But with both houses being equal, you don't get legislation through unless you get the support of the Senate. So, and this is the problem with the veto, that you can have one house that fits your most ideal conception of democracy, but if the other house is grossly malapportioned, or if ultimately the president can just negate legislation, even if it represents the kind of consensus that John McGinnis talks about, then it really doesn't matter at the end of the day that the House, putting partisan gerrymandering to one side, that the House might look pretty good on democracy. I would like to pick up John McGinnis's points, because, you know, if we're simply arguing theory, he's probably right. I'm more little d democratic than he is, and we can argue all day about who's right on the theory. But what I really think that Professor McGinnis is missing is that the current system doesn't provide all that much stability. That in the last days of his presidency, Bill Clinton was busy getting executive department agencies to put all sorts of things into law. That same thing is happening now with the Bush administration. There's something almost bizarre in the suggestion that really what's great about our Constitution is that it preserves stability of foreign alliance systems, because every day now the lead story is whether the single president of the United States is or is not going to change policy in the war, is or is not going to reach out to new allies without any genuine consultation with Congress on this point. So it's not that I oppose stability. It's not that I don't think that Professor McGinnis is making an important point about the virtues of a consensus-oriented system against kind of a pure majoritarian democracy. But I think we've got the worst of all worlds, in a sense, where we don't have an adequately democratic system, and we have a system that, because of the power placed in the president, ends up as often provoking instability as stability.
So much to talk about. I thank my guest, John McGinnis, joining us from Northwestern University. As always, Jack Beatty, News Point on news analyst, and Sanford Levinson, the author of the provocative new book, Our Undemocratic Constitution. Professor Levinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to all the rest of you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This has been On Point.